This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
So last time we were talking a little bit about TCP and IP and this whole suite of protocols that the internet runs on. So remember our definition of what the internet is. Our definition was that the internet is a network of networks that are all running the IP protocol suite, the TCP IP protocol suite. Okay. And so there were two things we had to get through there. What is a network of networks? And we kind of talked at a high level about that last time. We'll get into a bit more detail on that this time. And the other thing that we had to get through is, well, what is TCP and IP, and you know, what's really going on with those protocols? Okay. So the first thing we did, you know, when we were discussing this last week, was that we started to think about, you know, okay, how does a packet make its way? So remember, first of all, the internet is packet switched, so it's the fundamental piece of data moving through the internet is a packet. All larger pieces of data are broken into packets and sent through the network. And so the question we had to ask was, okay, how does a packet make its way from the source to the destination, right? And for that purpose anyway, the first thing you would have to know is, well, as the packet is moving through, you know, who should be, you know, so the packet starts, let's say the website's sending my computer something. Well, the first thing it'll probably do is send it to an adjacent router, what's called an internet router. And then the next question is, what should this router do with the packet? Right? And the router basically stores a table that says, for any traffic that's headed here, send packets to this guy. And that's all it stores. And so we talked last time about how the updating happens and how the tables are adapted. Now, we're going to move one level up from that and look at what's called the transmission control protocol. So we're going to assume that underneath the network has this protocol that makes sure that all routers are consistently updated with information that tells them, if I want to reach any given destination in the network, who should be the next router that I forward a packet to? Okay, that's what the internet protocol does. And so since we talked about that last time, I'm not going to spend an enormous amount of time, you know, on that. I'd rather, you know, I'd like to get to, okay, so let's see, we stopped here. If I remember right, I think we talked about exactly the fact that IP, the internet protocol, is only responsible for trying to send the packets forward. It doesn't actually promise anything, okay? So if you ship a packet into the internet is not telling you, I'm going to deliver this packet. It's only telling you, I'm going to do the best that I can. And the best that I can means the routers store these tables that say, well, for packets destined here, send it to the next router on this path. You know, so we said, well, what if this router is gone? Then he's basically sending packets into a vacuum, and they just get dropped, but he doesn't really care. He doesn't pay any attention to that, okay? And that obviously raises a big issue, which is, you know, so since internet routing is distributed, and what a computer scientist means by distributed is that there's no central authority who knows what the internet looks like at any given time, and routing is based on local decisions, the sort of problem that raised was one of reliability. You know, at the end, when I'm sending something, I do care about reliability. I want the packets that I send to eventually make it there. If they don't make it there, I'd like to, you know, I'd probably want to try to send them again. I mean, examples would be things like bills, for example. You know, before the advent of the internet, if we're paying bills through the mail, and you send a check in the mail, now there's some possibility that a check is going to be lost, okay? Now, what did you do when a check is lost? I mean, you didn't do anything. It's not that you did nothing, right? It's not. I mean, the company that wanted the money still wants the check, and in principle, you're, you know, a good standing citizen will still want to pay that bill. So typically, the answer is, well, you send another check. You cancel, you know, stop the one that you sent, and you send another one. And that process, the process of sending another one, is not anything that the middle of the network guarantees. It's not anything the internet protocol guarantees. So the question is, how does that guarantee get achieved? Okay. So in particular, you know, this is something I want to emphasize again. It's such a big driver of the way the internet's designed. Basically, this argument, which is called the end-to-end argument, is that functionality that can only be provided at the ends of the network should not be put in the middle. Right? And the original designers felt that reliable delivery of packets was something that should not be put in the middle. It's something that should only be put at the ends. And we talked about an example, you know, of why this is the case last time, and so I won't do that in full detail, but I'll give sort of a high-level overview. You know, why is reliable delivery something you don't want to put in the middle? Well, the reason is that if you have multiple links that fail on one path, then each of those routers is going to try to keep retransmitting on that path. And so now, you know, the first guy on that path who sees something is missing will say, ah, this link is broken, let me keep retransmitting. But it wouldn't matter if he got it across that first link, because there's other links in the path that are broken too, and he doesn't know that. So in that case, it's not sensible for him to try to you know, retransmit things that are lost. He might as well just say, well, I could try to retransmit this thing over the link that I'm connected to, but it's just going to get lost again anyway down the line, right? So the analogy would be, you know, suppose that FedEx only runs two routes, one from San Francisco to New York and one from New York to London. And if their airline, if the airplane that flies from San Francisco to New York goes down, and the airplane that flies from New York to London happens to, you know, have some maintenance problem, so you have these two airplanes out at once, well, it doesn't make sense to spend an enormous amount of money trying to send all your packages from New York, from San Francisco to New York on another carrier, because when they get there, they're just going to be stuck again since FedEx's airplane is out all the way from New York to London. What you'd like to do is realize, hold on, these are both out. I'd really like to retransmit, ideally along a different path, all the way from San Francisco to London, right? There's no point to retransmitting only part of the way along the path when the rest of the path is out anyway, okay? So that's what we're going to look at now, is what's called the transmission control protocol. So that this example was what we talked about last time. So the transmission control protocol is meant to provide reliable delivery from one end of the network to the other, with the understanding that the middle is going to try to do the best it can, but may fail sometimes. It may not actually end up moving packets where it said it would. So what's the basic idea? A sender sends a packet. So what does that mean? You're sitting at your computer. Actually, let's take the other side. So, you know, you requested that you'd like some CNN content. So the CNN server, you know, takes a web page, let's say, that it's sending you. And we talked about this last time briefly, but a web page is really potentially an enormous number of elements, images, links, stories, all kinds of things. So let's just pick one image on the CNN web page. Let's say the CNN logo. Right? So it breaks the CNN logo into some packets, and it starts shipping them into the internet. And they're all addressed, saying they're going to your computer. Okay. So the sender sends these packets in, and what does the receiver do? Well, when the receiver gets the packet, and by receiver here I mean CNN sending those set of packets to you, I mean you, when you get the packets, your computer sends what's called an acknowledgement of receipt. This is not unlike return receipts at the post office. Okay, so you can actually pay for the service on regular mail. You get this, like, you know, green receipt that's attached to your package. When it gets to the destination, the sender is supposed to take the receipt off. Either, you know, sometimes you can require a signature and then put it back in the mail, and that comes back to you. Right? Oftentimes we use this for things like legal documents. So the receiver sends that acknowledgement. And what does the sender do? If the sender never gets an acknowledgement for the packet, he resends it. Now look at how in just one rule, we're covering ourselves against multiple modes of failure. Okay? What could go wrong? Well, what could go wrong, first of all, is that maybe the link right next to the sender goes down. Maybe another link further down the path goes down. Right? So depending on how many links there are, first of all, we're protecting ourselves against any of the links from the sender to the receiver going down. In turn, we're also protected against the possibility that although the receiver gets it and sends an acknowledgement, that links fail on the path from the acknowledgement back to the sender. Actually, sorry, so you weren't here last week, right? What was your name?
Jereen.
Oh, okay, you emailed me as well, I think, didn't you? Great. So, no problem. So for all the students, I was trying to get a few words of background, you know, what their sort of interest in the course was. So could you just tell me a couple sentences and what your
interest?
Yeah, interest and background as well on kind of where you're coming from.
My name is Jereen. Hoshi is my last name, and I work for the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. I just ran after you.
Everybody.
Filmmakers want is to share their work and maybe make some money so that they can invest it in their next project. And for the internet is a great hope for us filmmakers, but with this whole net neutrality issue, it's really obscure, you know, what's going to happen next.
Right.
So I'm here to educate myself.
Good, good. Hopefully you can educate me in the process as well. So that's the other thing I told everyone last week, was that I'm hoping to learn as much as you guys do. Okay, so. What we're just talking about here, then, is that this basically protects against a variety of forms of problems in the middle. First of all, it protects against a situation where the packet that the sender sent gets lost in the middle. It also protects if the acknowledgement gets lost in the middle, because notice that he might not get the acknowledgement for one of two reasons. Either what he sent was lost or what the receiver sent was lost. But there's a distinct difference in those two types of failures. If what he sends is lost, that's a bad thing. Clearly, in that situation, you should send it again. If what he sends is received, but the acknowledgement is lost, that's a situation when you probably don't want to send again. Right? So there is the possibility of some redundancy here, that you may send at times when, in reality, if someone had, you know, if God could see the entire network, he would know, what are you doing? Why are you sending that again? In fact, the receiver got it. It was just his acknowledgement that was lost. Okay. Now, part of the reason that this is okay is because there's a real difference between digital content and mail. So, you know, consider sending a diamond ring through the mail. Of course, most of us wouldn't do this, but let's suppose we did. You send the ring through the mail, and you attach a return receipt. And you never get the return receipt. Now, suppose you apply the same policy. That would mean you resend the diamond ring, another diamond ring, okay? Now, of course, we don't do that. Right? What would you more likely do? You'd probably pick up the phone, you'd call, you'd, you know, do an enormous number of things. Ideally, you would never send the diamond ring in the first place, but you would certainly not do this. On the other hand, on the internet, it's effectively, you know, when I say cost, I don't want to say cost-free, because everything has a cost at some level, but this is nothing like sending a diamond ring through the mail, okay? It's basically a regeneration of a digital sequence of bits, and so there's not the same sort of cost associated to having to resend the packet. So the loss of efficiency, because you may sometimes send when you didn't need to, is not really an enormously problematic loss for the network. Okay. So does everybody understand what's happening here? Yeah.
Does that acknowledgement happen for every packet or just after the?
Every packet.
Every packet.
Every packet. Absolutely. Every packet. Yeah. You might think that's a big load, right? The acknowledgments actually turn out to be quite small, relatively speaking. So people don't often talk about the load that induces. Now, I do, since you asked, let me come back to this point about, you know, how often things are sent and so on. That's actually a very interesting issue, and after you're done here, you may learn a way that you can speed up your internet connection at home. So, sorry, was there something wrong, or? Was there something wrong up there?
Oh, is that an air conditioning vent up there? I think I'm going to have to move.
Oh, Yeah, actually, I'd suggest you might, because I don't think we get individualized climate control in the room, so. Oh, okay, sorry about that. I mean, it's likely that it is probably that, but air conditioning I'm doubtful of, because Stanford tends to not like to turn on air conditioning, but. okay, so just as a pictorial depiction of what's going on here, you know, I emphasize the internet protocol is what's going on down here, and that's acting between routers. Okay, this is often what's in sort of computer science parlance called the network layer. You might think that's a strange name because every layer is operating at the network, so it doesn't really make, you know, it's not exactly a very descriptive term. But what they mean by network layer is that it's the internet protocol is something that works between adjacent nodes that are connected by links in the network. The transmission control protocol, or TCP, on the other hand, does not work between adjacent nodes. It works between nodes that are potentially extremely far away, but are connected through the network, okay? And that's really an interesting thing to understand. You know, we think of this as something that's part of the network. In reality, this is something which runs, you know, on top of the internet protocol, which is really the thing that sort of ties the network together, okay? So this is the thing that, you know, again, where have we gotten to here? We've identified a protocol that provides reliable end-to-end delivery, okay? So now I want to tell you just a little bit more detail exactly what TCP does. So beyond just ensuring reliable delivery, and ultimately reliable delivery just, you know, amounts to this retransmission of packets that are lost, or, you know, packets where you don't get an acknowledgement. By the way, I should ask a question because I'm surprised that nobody asked me this. Right? So this is, it's analogous to the tree falling in the forest type of proverb, which is, if the acknowledgement is lost, how do you know that?
I was wondering.
Right? Why didn't you just didn't wait long enough? So the diamond ring example is a good one. I mean. You know, if you sent it in the mail, you probably wouldn't just wait a day before sending another one. You know, you'd wait some amount of time, but you still would never be sure. And of course, we've all had situations where mail sent has potentially been delayed for months before it's received at the other end. So how do you know? Well, it turns out that at a fundamental level, actually, what's done is very analogous to what you would do with the mail. I mean, there's no way to identify when something is lost in the mail. And so usually, we just kind of have our own mental clock of when we think it's been about long enough. right? With bills, it's pretty simple. There's a due date, check hasn't been received. You know, you may call and get a grace period, but at best, you're going to probably send the thing within a couple weeks if it's been late. And TCP is really not very different from that. It does almost exactly the same thing. You know, it looks and waits. It sends the packet out and it waits. If the acknowledgement doesn't come back in a certain amount of time, then it sends again. If it still doesn't get an acknowledgement, it sends again, right? And basically, the mechanism that it implements allows it to send three times in a row the same packet after waiting a fixed amount of time, which is called a timeout period. And if at the end of that period, it still hasn't gotten an acknowledgement back for the same packet, you experience what's called a timeout. So I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but you know, you may sometimes see when you're surfing the web, the browser pulls up connection timed out. Okay? Mm-hmm. When you see the phrase connection timed out, that's really what's happening. What's happening is it's trying to send through. In that situation, you're trying to talk to a web server and request something. And that means you're sending packets out to the web server. And you're just not getting an acknowledgement back. And after trying a sufficient number of times, it throws its hands up and says, OK, you know, there's nothing I can do. And that's when you see the timeout. Okay? So it's really not unlike what you would do in a practical mail sense. Yeah.
So when you send a message off and you know, it grinds away and it doesn't come back soon enough, you say, oh, something screwed up, and you stop it, and then you send it again, and it pops back right away. Does that mean it got lost, the acknowledgement wasn't coming back, or the path it took first time, the router got...
Yeah, and so we're going to actually, you know, I, as we talked about contracts and things, we're going to see, I think on one of the slides that I have, you know, one of the things I try to do is pull terms out of a lot of contracts. And one of the things you'll see is a description of an enormous number of things that could go wrong in the middle of the network. Now, for the question that you just asked, the pertinence is, really, all of these things do happen. I mean, it could be lost on the way out. It could be lost on the way back. It could be, you know, transmitted through some extremely circuitous route. Actually, sometimes what can happen is it could just get stuck in an infinite loop in the middle of the network. That's a very fascinating situation, and you know, you might wonder how that happens, but it is possible that packages keep circulating around, and routers try to maintain enough state to prevent this from happening, but it's impossible. So, I think as a general rule, the best way to think about failure of the network is that just about anything you can envision going wrong with the mail can go wrong with the packet, and it likely will happen more frequently than it does with the mail, actually. Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah. That's a good question. Okay. So that's one thing, right? Is this reliable delivery? But the other thing is there's another problem with just reliable delivery, right? So here's the basic problem. Suppose you know there's only 10 people in the world, and there's only one link, and all the 10 people are on you know distributed 5 and 5, 5 on one side of the link, 5 on the other, and they're paired up into sender and receiver. And so all 5 senders want to send to the 5 receivers on the other side. Well, if it was only about reliable delivery, what would I do? I'd just blast away, right? Eventually, stuff is going to get through. So TCP also faces another problem, which is one of fairness. How do I take a limited resource, which is the amount of capacity in the network, and distribute it among all the different users that want to try to use it? Now you might think, well, why is this an issue? I hear all these, you know, I hear all these stories about how there's plenty of capacity in the network, right? Well, you hear stories about plenty of capacity. On the other hand, the link that you have, this is just, you know, for a simple example, the link you have from your own home to the internet is typically one which is much lower capacity than anything you're going to face in the middle. And it will frequently be the case if you're downloading a video or something like that, that you do hit the capacity of that link. Now, particularly for people who are in cable modem access, you're actually sharing the link to the rest of the internet with everybody else in your neighborhood. You may not know, I mean, I always wonder how interesting it must be in neighborhoods of sort of the technocratic where everybody knows that this is what's happening, that you know that it's being shared with your neighbor. And typically we have sort of good neighborly relations, but you can envision that sort of bandwidth hogging is the sort of thing that isn't really it's equivalent to basically, you know, somebody building a fence on your side of the lawn. You wouldn't want your neighbor to be using 95% of this link available to the rest of the internet. I mean, ideally, it should be shared equally between everyone. So, well, that raised the question for the designers of the internet as well. Who should be responsible for making sure that there's kind of fair sharing? And you could argue it's an economic question, but the problem is the packets are generated too quickly for it to be just purely economic. The network itself, the protocols itself, have to do something to be fair. They have to make sure that there's some equitable division of resources. And so TCP is in part also responsible for making sure the packets aren't injected too fast or too slow. And the too fast or too slow here is really relative to kind of a nominal notion of fairness. Okay, so I'll explain what I mean by this. So what TCP does is that it maintains what's called a sending window. And at any given point in time, you know, so the way to think about the window is this is maintaining the state of packets that are currently in flight to your receiver. All right? So again, let's suppose that you had a book, and you tear the book into pages, and you put each of them in an envelope, and you send the pages to your receiver one by one. Now, one thing you could do is just walk to the post office and dump all the pages in the mailbox. But another thing you could do is send out the first six pages, right? And then you're going to wait to hear back from the guy you just sent them to before you send out something else. So what happens? Well, what happens is you first send out this window, and if you get back, so suppose you send this out, and suppose now you know your receiver on the other end gets all six of those packets, all six of those pages. He sends back acknowledgments for all of them. Suppose nothing went wrong and you got them all. Well, what happens then is you remove all these packets from the window and you flush in a new set of seven, a new set of six, sorry. Okay, so that would be pages 7 through 12 that you put in. Okay, but in addition to that, because you got everything back just in good order, you say, well, maybe I could just squeeze an extra one in there. You know, maybe everything's working well enough that if I just squeeze one more page through the network, nothing really would go wrong. Okay, so you in addition to the six new pages that you flood in, these new packets, 7 through 12, you also take page 13. Okay, so you add in another packet, and now you send those seven out at once. So last time you sent six, now you're sending seven. Okay, so you send those out. Well, what could happen now is that So this is what you would do in this case. Let's actually step back to this for a second. Consider the other alternative, which is after you send these six back, you find out that one of them got lost. Now, again, as I said, you don't actually ever know it was lost. You just never got an acknowledgement back, even after trying and trying. Right? If that happens, so if you didn't get an acknowledgement, then what you'd like to do is, first of all, resend a packet that you didn't get an acknowledgement for. But then you also think to yourself, so I sent out six, and one of them, I postulate, was lost. Well, next time around, it's probably not a smart idea to send six. I should probably send a little bit less than that. And so if one was lost, the next time around, instead of sending six, you just send three. You send half. Now, there's a big asymmetry here. You build up slowly. So you send six, and you get them all back, you add one more on. And then next time, you send seven. But if one is lost, you really ramp back quick. You ramp back by half the next time around. So that's a big
asymmetry.
That's the way TCP works, yeah. There's a big asymmetry there.
You said there is when you download big files, right? You're not able to, let's say, you know, you're downloading a big file with 150 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get a few of them first, and then you know, some of the pictures are not there.
Let's see. So give me an example of a file that you're thinking of. Ah, okay. Yeah, and so you're saying as it's filling in.
You know, the first pages you are getting.
Yep.
But I also see some information on the, you know, the whole.
Yeah.
You may be able to get. So there seems to be some way of distributing.
Yeah, so I want to distinguish here between what's happening when you're downloading something, and so what exactly you see on the screen. Or for video, the analogous thing would be when you watch streaming video. Sometimes it's choppy, and sometimes it's very smooth. Okay, so I want to distinguish between that and kind of what I'm talking about here in the sense that I'm not actually talking at all about what the application is doing here. I mean, the way that the application decides to break up things into packets can be quite different for different applications. So in that situation, what might be happening is that the particular division it's chosen is one that when the network was slow, it was sending things from later, and when the network is fast, it's trying to get stuff that's from the front of the file. But that's very application dependent. So everything we're talking about here is this is like raw substrate that every application in the internet runs on. And so every application has to make a decision of what pages do I put in here. So again, as an analogy, you might imagine that the book that you're sending is maybe it's a book where three pages are far more important than the rest. We can all think of examples of what something like that might be, but maybe the table of contents is the first thing you'd like to get through. Okay, well, because of that, it's likely that you'd want to put the most important pages into the first packets, and then later pages, other pages into later packets. So how you sequence data into packets, I've put them in order here in terms of page number, The reality is that's up to the application. How does it decide to put things into packets? All I'm talking about is once the application's decided an ordering of how it wants to send stuff out, then what actually happens with TCP? Okay.
This one, you lost a packet, so wouldn't you resend it?
So I'm saying, remember that if you resend the packet and it just never gets through, if you send it three times it never gets through, you time out. So at that point the connection breaks.
Right.
So what I'm talking about here is that you lost the packet.
Yes.
But the next time, or maybe two times later when you sent it, it actually got received and you got an acknowledgement.
Okay, so you sent six and you lost one of them.
Yep.
I'd say that was number three for discussion.
Yeah.
So then you send three and then 7, 8, 9, or do you?
Yeah, so I want to be a bit careful here about the exact sequencing. It's a bit of a subtlety to implementation as to exactly the order it's done in. But let's think of it for...
My assumption then was wrong. I thought whenever you miss one, that was your highest priority to send.
No, that is absolutely... That is certainly absolutely correct. Sorry, that is correct. It is. So let me rephrase what you just said, and it should clarify this issue. So I sent 1 through 6.
Yeah.
Suppose 3 was lost.
Right.
I'll retransmit 3 first. I will do that. And I will wait until I get an acknowledgement back from 3. And when I get that acknowledgement back from 3, I do send more packets out. So the timeout doesn't happen. I continue my transmission. It's just that the next time I send, I only send 3 instead of 6.
So yeah. This is after you've taken care of the first 6.
It's actually after you've taken, exactly. It's after you've taken care of them. Yeah. Now, the reason I said there's some subtlety is because actually in practice, TCP moves the window in sort of a smooth way forward. And there's a variety of implementations that sort of affect that. So I don't want to dwell on those details, but you're right that packet that was lost is assigned. Yeah, you don't forget about it. I mean, clearly it's important. Remember, TCP is charged with reliable delivery first. So no matter what else happens, its job is to make sure that the packets you told it you wanted out actually get there. Yep. Okay. So, after what we've just seen, let's think of this thing called a round trip time, which is the total time from you to the receiver and back. Okay, now again, that's a kind of vague notion. It really depends on the route that you take through the internet. It actually depends a lot on things like processing delays. But let's just pretend that there's some nicely defined time from me to the receiver and back. So what happens? I send out one of these windows of packets every round trip time. Then I wait to get acknowledgments back. If I didn't lose anything, I'd move the window up. But if I lost some packets and had to retransmit them, I half the window down. And you can already see why there's an issue about the exact mechanics of implementation, because it takes me more than a round trip time to discover that a packet was lost. Typically, that timeout that you wait is longer than a round trip, slightly longer than a round trip time. So you have to be a little bit careful on the implementation side here. But I don't, again, this is not a class about implementation, so I don't really want to dwell on that. The intuition is, I move up slowly, I back off fast. Now, why would I do that? Well, what you'd like is you'd like yourself to be able to cautiously explore available bandwidth as long as it's there. But when you hit this problem that you've exhausted available bandwidth, then what there's one of two things happening. Either you're sharing the link with somebody else, and the two of you put together are exhausting available capacity, or you by yourself are exhausting available capacity. And in either of those situations, you need to make sure you back off. Okay? Now, how much should I back off? If I back off only once at a time, then I'm going to be losing a lot in the meantime. So the reason that there's such an asymmetry here is that there's an asymmetry in the two sort of bad effects of these two things. The bad effect of going up slowly is that you have unused capacity in the network. Okay, granted, that's a bad thing, but it's not as bad as losing packets, right? So unused capacity is a bad thing, but not as bad as losing packets. And if I lose packets, I don't want to lose any more, so I back off hard. If everything gets through, yeah, I'd like to be able to send more, but the fact that it takes me a little bit longer to ramp up isn't such a bad thing, it's not such a bad thing that I'm losing capacity. Now, I just want to make one very quick comment on this. That argument turns out to be true in low-speed networks, okay? In networks, relatively speaking, that have low capacities or low-speed links. So it's a reasonable argument for things like, the sort of old modem, telephone modem type connections. It's actually a very bad argument for very high-speed networks. Because in very high-speed networks, what ends up happening here is it takes you an eternity to ramp up far enough to take advantage of all this massive capacity that's there, okay? Now, and not only that, because you back off so quickly when you hit that boundary, you're going to be spending an enormous amount of time running at half capacity, basically. Okay? So I'm going to start out low. I'll build up. I lose a packet. Whoa, better back off. And when you back off, you back off giving up half the capacity, basically. And you just keep doing that over and over again. Okay? So, you know, that's a very heuristic argument, but that argument suggested that maybe for high bandwidth networks, this was not the best solution. And that spurred a lot of recent research on modifications of TCP that actually do quite a bit better. That's one comment. Now, the other thing is from a real-world consumer perspective, there's actually an enormous amount of things you can do on your own computer to change the way TCP works. Right? One of these things is that you can change the number of packets by which TCP increases the window every time it gets a successful window back. So this is one. You can really make that a lot bigger than one. Okay. I hesitated to sort of make this, you know, a link or something off the class website, but certainly if you do search on like TCP modification in Windows or TCP modification in Mac or TCP modification in Linux, you'll turn up a large number of very interesting links that tell you how to change parameters in Windows to eke out better bandwidth, basically to improve, you know, effectively make TCP more aggressive than it is by nature. Right now, when it gets more aggressive, what they're trying to help you with there is the idea that your high-speed connection to the internet is high bandwidth, and maybe it's not exploiting that bandwidth efficiently. That's what they tell you. The reality is it's actually a very good way to make your TCP what would be called malicious by network designers. Because if you want, you can push that to an extreme where it effectively backs off very, very little and ramps up very aggressively. Okay? So we're going to talk about a protocol, actually, that was built into the internet that does almost exactly that, and then, you know, compare and contrast it with what's going on here. But I just want to tell you about this sort of opportunity to tweak your own machines to get a little bit better bandwidth than you get. And it actually, you know, there's very interesting stories. I mean, some people had one, you know, back in the days when high-speed connections were limited to 1.5 megabits per second, you could, you know, irrelevant, independent of what that means, you could ramp up by a factor of 4 if you did this in some cases. And, you know, then more recently, I think through a combination of maybe, let's say, better network management by the providers as well as higher capacities that are given to you anyway up front, it's a little bit harder to eke out the same kind of gains. But depending on what your own network circumstances are, you can actually do a reasonably bit better. It's worth looking into. Okay, so, wait a second, that's strange.
Have you heard anything like could a person get kicked off Comcast for doing that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. You need to be pretty egregious. But again, we'll look at a Comcast contract. And actually, this part, though, I didn't copy. I mean, the contract is very interesting in and of itself. So for all the contracts, I have links to where you can find them, and you can read through more details. But it is true. In the contract, the contract with Comcast consists of two things. One is terms of service. What do they promise you? And the other is an acceptable use policy, which is actually what you promise them. It's a very strange thing to think that you're buying this from them, paying for it, and yet you're promising something. And one of the things that you're promising is exactly, I mean, you'd be amazed at the list of restrictions that you're promising them you won't undertake, that you won't do things like that, but you won't share your connection with others. I mean, we all do that on a regular basis. So we'll see more of that later. So actually, I guess what happened here is the show was set to end early, and I didn't want that. So let's see. Okay, so we were here. So the mechanism serves to discover and utilize available capacity to the destination. That's basically what I've said already. And so the question is, you know, is TCP good? Is it the right answer for all, you know, is it the jack of all trades? If we started by saying we want reliable delivery, is TCP the best answer for reliable delivery, the only answer for reliable delivery, okay? I mean, I'm not talking about these, like, fine-scale variations of how how do you tweak the way it works. I mean, at a high level, it's just the right thing to be doing. Well, what is it good for? It's really good when you need all the packets to arrive. One problem with TCP is obviously it doesn't guarantee anything about the delay to get those packets there. You know, again, back to our guy with the diamond, it's not saying anything about how many times you're going to have to ship that diamond out or, you know, how slow or fast is the window going to be moving. There's no promises. Not only that, TCP can't really control the route the packets take. That's controlled by the middle of the network. So some packets might be routed through Asia, others through Europe, and it doesn't have any control over that. I mean, the best it can do is just make sure to retransmit as necessary to get packets to the destination. So it can't promise you anything about how long packets will take to get to their destination. Okay, and not unlike the post office. The post office doesn't tell you, unless you buy, you know, expedited service, even priority mail doesn't have guaranteed delivery. It says 2 to 3 days, but that's not promised. It's just expected. Okay, so there's no promise here in TCP. Now, what is this good for? Well, one good example of this is you go to bed at night And before you go to bed, you know, you start a download from iTunes of, you know, a 3-hour movie or something like that. And you wake up in the morning and you go look at iTunes and the movie's there, you know, and it's been completely downloaded. Well, you didn't really care how long it took. It could take 2 hours or 8 hours. You're asleep most of that time. In my case, it's 2 hours or 4 hours. But anyway, you're asleep most of that time. And so it doesn't really matter how long it takes as long as it's done by the time you get up. And that's a pretty wide bound on delay that you're willing to tolerate. So as long as all the packets arrive, that file will be there intact. And if the movie is there intact, you can watch. Okay, so that's a good example of where TCP works really, really well. And it is definitely because of that, it's used for most common internet tasks. It's used for all email, nearly all web browsing. In fact, it's important to notice that a single page can open many TCP connections. I mentioned the CNN logo last time. In fact, on a CNN web page, you know, it depends. You can sort of count these things up yourself, but you can have on the order of 100 elements that are all independently downloaded. Open, so that basically means you might think that you open one connection and send them all through the same connection. Actually, what happens is there's 100 parallel connections opened over which all these elements are downloaded. Right? So there's an enormous number of these things open at any given time. And you might also think that web browsing is the sort of thing where you do care about getting it soon. You do care about delay. And that has motivated the idea that maybe TCP isn't the right way to be doing all web delivery, that sometimes you would like a better guarantee that, hey, when the user clicks on a link, it doesn't take them 6 minutes to get that link through. I mean, that there's some guarantee of how fast it's going to get there. It's especially important for web browsing because psychologically and you know, behaviorally, it's been observed, as I'm sure it doesn't surprise you, that people are very, very sensitive to the delay after they click on a link until the page shows up. If that delay passes a certain threshold, then behaviorally, there's a tremendous increase in the dissatisfaction of the user with the web experience. It's sort of been observed through human surveys. And I mean, again, we're all humans, and we all use the web, so I'm sure this doesn't surprise you. Okay, and so that, you know, that issue says, well, okay, it's used for web browsing. Is it the right answer for web browsing? It's an important question. And then file downloads, as I just discussed. So here's an example where TCP is not the right answer, which is a telephone call. Or, you know, we've heard the term voice over IP, and what voice over IP refers to is, I'm going to make telephone calls, but I'm going to route where those calls go. I'm basically going to take a call, break it into packets, and then use the internet protocol to send those packets. Okay. Now, voice over IP is interesting because you don't have the call in advance to break into packets. The call's, you know, happening as you and I talk, so packets are being created as you and I are talking, and they're being sent out. Now, one of those packets is going to be pretty useless to you if you get it 10 minutes later, right? With a phone call, actually, I believe the human sort of tolerance for latency is on the order of a couple hundred milliseconds, okay? So that's, you know, if you made international calls, then you know that there can be a delay, and which is quite frustrating on an international call. The delay that's tolerable happens to be on the order of 200 milliseconds, right? So it turns out that, first of all, for telephone calls, all packets don't matter. You can actually do fine if you just get most of them through. They have very sophisticated coding schemes that ensure that even if some of them are lost, the caller can still be heard. In fact, these schemes are so sophisticated that they actually operate, that they're willing to handle multiple rates of transmission. And they adaptively change the call quality based on the available bandwidth. So they're actually very, very sophisticated, and they can tolerate a decent amount of loss. And actually, anybody who makes, you know, a cellular call often observes that there's a widely variable range of quality levels even with the same two devices. In part, that's due to the fact that cellular carriers and cellular devices are very sophisticated about how they translate your speech into bits. But a critical fact here, as we just said, delay is unacceptable. You can handle losing some stuff, but you cannot handle delay. Now look back at this slide here. It's exactly the opposite of this. Here, TCP says all packets get there and delay doesn't matter. And now I'm giving you something where delay matters, delay is almost the whole ball game, and all packets don't have to get there. Now, not surprisingly, you wouldn't use TCP for something like this. The internet has another protocol, which was really the sort of favorite protocol for voice over IP providers, which is called the User Datagram Protocol, or UDP. And UDP is really, it's an incredible and simple and beautiful protocol. You just throw stuff into the network as fast as you want. That's it. Nothing else. You have whatever you want, and you just shove it in. And it takes whatever you give it. No guarantees at all.
That's the same as IP. What does it give you that IP does?
So remember that IP is not a protocol that moves packets. It's a protocol.
Router.
It's a protocol between routers that establishes where packets should go. And then when packets arrive at a router, it tells that packet where to go next. But UDP, IP is not something that talks to an application. So an application says, hey, I have all these packets to send. It hands them off. IP doesn't take them and then send them through the network. Now, why doesn't it do that? Well, because IP can form the substrate for multiple ways of sending packets through the network. One we saw was TCP. And UDP was created basically to be the absolute minimalist interface between the application and IP. So at some level, it's trying to do that. It's trying to make it so IP is doing it for you. But you still need this interface, because IP, as an interface goes, as a language goes, does not talk to applications. Yeah, and then in between IP and the application, there's actually a variety of other protocols as well that are sort of hybrids between UDP and TCP, but won't get into those. So this is very simple. I don't need to even put up a slide to explain how this works. You just, you know, as packets come in, you just put them into the network. No guarantees, no acknowledgments, nothing. Okay? In particular, there's no delay guarantees here either. Right? There's no delay guarantees here either. That's a recurring theme in this course. The internet as a network provides no guarantees of service. No guarantees of delay, no guarantees of how many packets will be lost, nothing. So it's not like this fixes the problem on delay. It's not like suddenly we made sure the delay is going to be bounded, or you know, that things will get there in 200 milliseconds like you need for speech. Okay? But what this does give you is the possibility to start flooding a lot more data and a lot more redundancy into the network. And if you could just get lucky and make sure that most of the time, see, what you're really taking advantage of here is you're not able to guarantee this still by using UDP. You don't get any delay guarantees. But because some packets can be lost, UDP lets you send a lot more packets all the time. Right? And that's one of the key facts that Voice over IP uses. It essentially just builds in a lot of redundancy, sends a lot more packets. Some of those might be lost, but enough aren't, and enough are received with low enough delay under a good connection that you can actually make a phone call. And if you've used Skype, I just talked to someone in Thailand yesterday on Skype, it is remarkable. The quality on Skype is better than it is if I make a phone call to that person using, you know, using my local telephone company. So Skype is a, you know, is an IP telephony service, basically. Not voice over IP, but IP telephony. So here's the real question, and here's sort of the food for thought, which is, you know, suppose that, so we've seen two things now. We've seen UDP and TCP. UDP is just flooding the network with packets, no guarantees, nothing. And TCP is this reliable transmission protocol that backs off and plays nice. OK, well, suppose they're using the same link. Why was that likely? What if your neighbor is making a phone call and you're downloading a movie? OK, well, now suppose, you know, your neighbor says, I'm not happy with just the phone call. I actually want a video conference, right? And real-time video conferencing is, again, using very similar technology. It's effectively based on something like UDP at the bottom. Well, what happens is the UDP guy increases his sending rate. He never backs off. Doesn't matter what happens in the network. He never backs off. Just keep pumping it up. And as he keeps pumping it up, the TCP just gets destroyed. Okay? So what does the TCP do? It reacts to loss. So imagine there's a pipe. And right now, the pipe's being shared equally between the two. The UDP guy starts ramping up the share of the pipe he wants. Well, he's squeezing the TCP guy against the boundary of that pipe more and more. And the more the TCP guy gets squeezed, the more packets he's going to lose. Every time he loses a packet, he backs off to half the window size. Every single time. All that time, this guy's doing nothing, the UDP stream. Right? If any of you, you know, have opened a real-time connection at the same time that you do a file download, it's a very, I think it may be harder to see now with high bandwidth links, but it was certainly a very distinct difference as recently as a couple of years ago, that you would see that, you know, you can have a dramatic impact on the quality of your download based on the just opening a streaming connection. It's a real issue, actually. And that raises the question, why bother using TCP at all? If we think of this as a game where each of us has our own, you know, our own computers and the own, what if we could control what we did? Why would we bother using TCP at all if we were up against this? I mean, it's a race to the bottom.
Well, if you're downloading a file that has to have integrity from the entire size of the file, like a spreadsheet or something, you need to get all the packets.
That's right. So what does UDP do? What would a UDP approach to that say? Just send more. Keep sending more. What I want to do is I want to take the TCP. So what I would do is I would take the TCP, and I would just remove the part that backs off. I would keep everything else, but I would remove the part that backs off. And I would actually ramp up faster. In fact, I would never ramp up at all. I would just blast away and just keep resending stuff that didn't get received. See, because if you think about it, the only reason to back off is either to play nice or because you're hitting this boundary, right? Now, if you're going to resend often enough, you don't really care about the boundary that much. You know, you could control that yourself up there by not backing off. And so this is a big issue, and it's such a big issue that it's given rise to a term, which is called TCP friendly. And now, the real goal for streaming traffic then is to design protocols which play nice with TCP, which don't hog the link, which try to use the fair share, which deliver as much capacity as available, but don't hog the link against TCP traffic. I think that's great, and that's a very interesting research agenda for computer scientists. But on the other hand, there's still this big incentive problem. We can put all the protocols out there we want as computer scientists. The bottom line is, if somebody wants to blast away, they can. And the only controls we can impose are to start to change the middle of the network, how it responds to different types of traffic. This is something which is a long-standing debate, which is that if you really want to distinguish between things that care about loss, like file transfers, and things that care about delay, like telephone calls, then you have to start distinguishing in the middle of the network between packets that come from telephone calls and packets that come from file transfers. And the network doesn't do that. The network is very dumb. The network looks at the destination address, looks at the routing table, and sends the packet on. Okay? So it does not do this. If it does not do this, you can't distinguish between those things. So a very interesting question here, and I think this is my next slide. Yeah, this is a great, I love this example, okay? Really, I should have put Bell Canada here because that's where I got this example. So there's a representative of Bell Canada who told me about this. So your company, it's obvious, many of us know this, that there's many telephony providers that provide DSL access, internet access, right? SBC, AT&T, and it used to be SBC, now AT&T in this area is one. So you sell two products. You sell internet access, you sell telephone service. Now, it's not surprising that customers who buy internet access are likely to use it to make phone calls, right? Using modern IP telephony services like voice over IP. So the question is, what happens to you when your customer buys a voice over IP service from a third party? It's really interesting. You're basically competing yourself out of your own business. Now, why is that happening? You could imagine what I should be doing is charging more. The problem is, as the network provider, I can't really tell the difference. Now, that's not entirely true. They're getting more sophisticated at being able to tell the difference between phone calls and file transfers. But they're still not quite sophisticated enough, nor would current regulations allow them, to be able to say, wait, that's a third-party voice over IP call that directly competes with my telephone service. I'm not going to let you use my network access for that. That is network neutrality. Okay, that is network neutrality. The point is, should the DSL provider be allowed to say, wait a second, why would I be selling somebody the opportunity to go buy telephone service from someone else? Why would I do that? Why would I enable that? Well, one reason you might enable it is envision a network where you could tell the difference. And you don't prohibit, but what you do is you charge in a way that effectively you're, as the provider, you're indifferent between selling real telephone service or recouping some of the costs through, an extra fee on third-party telephone service, right? Network neutrality advocates, sort of the staunchest network neutrality advocates, are extremely against this type of behavior because that is distinguishing traffic in the network. I think that one of the points about this example is that it's significantly more subtle than that. Okay, as a consumer, you should care about telephone traffic being different from a file transfer because your consumer experience is affected by that. You don't want UDP and TCP traffic to be sharing the same link all the time. UDP will win. It's not optimal. It's not good for anyone to be running a telephone call and a file transfer exactly the same way. Okay? And that means as a consumer, you may wish for a little bit of differentiation in the network between how telephone calls are treated and how file transfers are treated. When you wish for that, it starts to enable things you may not have thought of. It starts to enable this guy, the DSL guy, to identify that's a telephone call running on my data network and that's a file transfer. And when he can do that, he can charge telephone calls slightly differently than he charges data transfers. Okay? Yeah.
So if as the provider, I know that people are going to be using my DSL to make phone calls, why don't I just start offering voice over IP?
That's a great, great question. It's a great, and that question applies to many more industries than telephony or telecoms. There's a whole host of industries where it's called the innovator's dilemma, which is that you waited too long, basically, to to innovate. And after some point, it gets... Now, you're right that this isn't the sort of thing where they couldn't move fast enough. The real problem is that the margins on telephone service are really high. They're much, much higher than they are on data services. So you'd actually, while you could offer it, you can't, again, because you really can't... See, it's hard to offer the voice over IP service and then distinguish on price. Because once you've sold the customer the data access, he has a lot of different options for making calls over the internet. He could just use Skype. Now, Skype is free. So what are you going to charge? Well, you could charge an increment, maybe because you have better customer service. I don't know. I mean, DSL providers don't really have great customer service. So, you know, what are you paying for? I mean, that's the real problem. So this is a problem where, so, you know, next lecture, I do want to try to spend some time. This is a slight deviation from what my original plan was, but I do want to spend some time next lecture talking a little bit about a higher level sort of economic view of this problem and asking questions like this. How does pricing between multiple services and multiple providers interact, and why do we see the phenomena that we see? Okay, but
is there an analogy? I get cable, Comcast, mm-hmm. and so I can't get it without the cable TV, which I never use because I have a DirecTV, but they still charge me for it. But if they didn't, and they would want to have video on demand where I can use their internet service.
This is one thing.
That's a similar situation.
It's exactly the network neutrality argument that you see, right? The argument that's made is, if you're Netflix, I need a free distribution mechanism for video.
Right.
If you're Comcast, you say, I'm running a cable television network with pay-per-view movies. Why would I want Netflix delivering video on demand? It doesn't make sense to Comcast. And so, I mean, I want you to understand that the network neutrality debate, as it's written in papers, is something where there's an extremely politicized view on both sides. And neither side is completely right. I mean, the side that argues that we would never invest if we can't charge for, what that investment is going to be used for, it's really an extreme viewpoint. As well, the viewpoint that you should have a completely free and open internet with no distinctions at all is a bit naive, I think. So I'm not arguing, I mean, many of the arguments that I'm making seem to suggest that I keep pushing towards providers being able to charge for investment upgrades. That's not the point I'm making. I think that what this is trying to illuminate is the economics are very subtle. And technological improvements interact with economic changes in a very fundamental way in the internet, in a way that most of us aren't really used to seeing. And this example really highlights that. You as a consumer want better telephone service and better file transfer performance. Those two are difficult goals to achieve. The network has to help with that. So that means you as a consumer would like to have network changes that support such technology, but such changes immediately enable a different charging architecture. Okay? So as a consumer, you sort of have to be sensitive to that interaction between technology and economics. So we're going to talk more about how that economics plays out, but that's what I want to point out here. Okay. Oh, yeah, that was. You can call me Ramesh, by the way. I think
sorry.
Given that we're all about the same age, or I may be much younger than some of you, I definitely don't want you to use anything but my first name. But go ahead.
Ramesh, what is the current research? I don't know what word to use, but on the technology that would allow both file transfers and telephone.
Okay, so I guess I don't want to spend an enormous amount of time, but typically the way that network engineers have thought about this problem so far involves, again, with this notion of TCP friendliness, involves getting what's your fair share, basically. So that, the easiest thing to see is with one link. With one link, a network engineer would say that the fair share is basically if there's n flows going through the link, it's 1 over n for each flow. So if there's 10 flows, it's 1/10 of the link for each of them. And so what the initial research was is that you'd like to design these real-time streaming protocols that don't grab more than their fair share. That was on the network engineering side. But then this fair share question is really debatable, and we're going to get back to this again. I don't want to dwell on this too long. We're going to get back to the economics again. But what is the fair share? Okay, why is it 1/10 in this example? Well, what if one of them was a credit card transaction and the other 9 were spam? Right? I mean, then the fair share is obviously not 1/10 for all of them. But the problem is, again, the network has no way to know what's kind of worth a lot and what's not worth very much. Okay, there's no way to tell. So the network, I cannot emphasize enough, the network as it was envisioned is extremely simple. It's so simple that I think it should be something we all learn in high school. We should all know that the way the network forwards packets is it just looks at the destination, looks it up in a table, and sends it to the next router. It doesn't do anything else. Anything else it does is building on top of that. It's engineering on top of that. And there's a lot of that. But the network as it was envisioned doesn't do anything else. And so, what you're talking about, there's not
really... You're saying it's brilliant and it's
absolutely. Absolutely. We cannot... You can't put a value on how important the simplicity was. I mean, that's a major reason why HTTP could only work, because the substrate was so sort of simple and robust underneath that you had all these different things developed on top. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely true. Simplicity was a virtue in that sense. And that's a big tension now. I'm a very young networking researcher, relatively speaking, but I sort of have broader vision on this by virtue of the people I've interacted with, that there tends to be this trend every 15 years in networking research where there's a reversion to wanting to put more and more functionality into the network. Right? And you start to experiment with that, and then you see, wait a second, now it's gotten bloated, and so that wouldn't quite work. So you move back towards simplicity, move back towards complexity, and back and forth. I mean, the burgeoning complexity in the 90s was what's called ATM. ATM is asynchronous transfer mode networks. And that was a very complex but very elegant scheme, I think, at some level for network control. And eventually, it just didn't fly. I mean, the important parts didn't fly because it was just too complicated. And IP won, TCP IP won, because it was so simple. And so you have this cycle going on. OK, so I just want to make one last comment on this. The Bell Canada guy specifically, one of the interesting things he told me was, every year, they lose money on this transaction. They lose customers on the telephone service, and they win customers on data. These guys pay less than these. They lose money. Okay, pay less in the sense of pay less per unit cost to the provider. And it just keeps happening. You watch the curves, and they just keep losing money. And they're basically turning into a commodity that pushes bits instead of a service that delivers this high reliability telephone call possibility through the network. Remember we talked about circuit switching versus packet switching. Circuit switching is a very robust, very high quality service. Packet switching is basically the trough of internet access. I mean, it's just you get to push as much as you want.
Isn't that why AT&T is back into the RBOC business, because their long line business is going away?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, let me actually hold that question. I wonder if you can ask me that again when we talk about economics sometime next lecture, because I do want to get on to thinking about some of this other stuff. So maybe a good thing to do is actually this is a good time to take a break, and then we'll spend the last 45 minutes or so going through some initial internet economics. So maybe we'll come back at, a 5-minute break, so let's say 8:05, and I'll see some interesting examples of what's going on in the internet today. We're going to see a lot more interesting stuff with this lecture, and this will continue into the beginning of next lecture. So what I really want to talk about here, and I call it internet economics, that's a really bad term, because economics is a very big term, the internet's huge, so you put the two together and it's not clear what it means. What internet economics means here is that I want to try to understand more than just the network of networks running TCP/IP. I want to understand what's the glue that holds this network of networks together. Okay? Now, we mentioned in the first lecture that glue is contracts, that by some miracle, all these different network providers have, and network providers is just one example, but network providers, content providers, cable modem providers, DSL providers, have contracts with each other that glue networks together. And because those networks are glued together, it means I can talk to CNN, even though obviously, I pay Comcast. There's no particular reason for me to expect that CNN is also a customer of Comcast, right? So we don't need to be customers of the same network to be able to talk to each other. That glue that holds the network of networks together is not a technological glue. It's an economic glue. The glue is this contracting between providers, between the players of the internet. And so I want to first understand some basic contracts. This is a very stylized presentation, but one that almost everybody in the industry will use. And then we're going to talk about some implications. And there's 5 examples here. I don't want you to suggest that there isn't some organization to this. These all have exactly the same theme. What I want you to take away from all these examples, and I'm going to emphasize this because it may not be clear as we go through it, what I want you to take away is routing, the internet protocol, is a technological specification of how packets should move. Contracting is something that is an economic process, a business process. All of these examples highlight that these two things interact in a way that's completely inextricable. All right? Contracts have a first-order impact on how packets move through the internet, and you just cannot avoid it. And any attempt to think about either re-engineering the internet or implementing regulations that change the contracting structure would be really naive if you weren't aware of this relationship. So that's what this lecture is setting up. Next lecture, we're going to have this in the back of our minds. I mean, we'll finish whatever I don't do here today, early next lecture, and then the rest of next lecture, we're going to use this to guide our thinking on the policy side, on the regulatory side. So that's a slight change from what my initial program was. In the first lecture, I said that I wanted to talk about applications next time. But I was thinking it over, and I actually think it might be better to just take a sort of policy angle using some of the stuff we learned here. And we have two more lectures after that, so we'll fill in some of the rest of the stuff that we don't get to as we go through the last two. Okay, let's get going. So, what I want you to take away so far, what I wanted to spend that TCP/IP lecture on, was really how does the internet as it was designed work? And we kind of talked a lot about that. The point is that in that internet, the packet delivery idea was pretty simple. And we talked about IP, and IP basically is trying to find the shortest path from the source to the destination. Short could be interpreted a variety of ways, but ultimately, if everybody thinks of short the same way, maybe short is distance, geographic distance, then the internet's protocol was designed to do that. But after deregulation, okay, fine, shortest paths would be great, but forget about shortest paths. How do you even know there is a path? There was no guarantee the networks would be glued together in the end, right? Remember how we talked about the NSFNet as the way that they structured the regulations? They tried to encourage the development of parallel long-haul private backbones. And as those grew, the NSFNet decided to withdraw. When it withdrew, it was like taking the training wheels off. And now you have this system where there's only contracts independently created holding it together, and it could be a wobbly system, and the contracts could fall apart, right? So the first problem really was just, how do packets find some path to their destination, let alone the best path, right? So in the internet, and so we talked about the fact that the internet is made up of all these independent administrative domains that we call autonomous systems. And last time, last lecture, we talked about how these are ISPs, universities, content providers. They're all independent administrative domains. And what that really means here is that from a network standpoint, they all have their own interests at heart. Okay, so by independent administrative domain, I'm referring to a group of nodes in the network that are all owned by sort of a single player that has all the nodes inside that network have the same interest, and they don't really care about what happens outside the network other than being able to reach whoever they want to talk to. Okay, so how are these glued together? Well, I've already confused you enough by talking about the internet protocol and routing, and now it turns out there's another piece of confusion to add to that, right? Which is the reality is you can basically forget everything I told you about shortest path routing. In between these autonomous systems, things don't work like that at all. All right? So shortest path routing ultimately is only used inside a single network. So it's used inside the CNN networks. It's used inside the AT&T network. It's used inside the Stanford network. But you remember that one of the things I just said was shortest path only makes sense if everybody evaluates short in the same way. All right? There's obvious reasons why we might not do that. Now, for example, one provider might think of short as distance, geographic distance. But Stanford, geographic distance might be kind of meaningless because it's a relatively small network. So maybe it evaluates short on the basis of where it thinks it has a lot of capacity and where it has a little. Okay? So the way that different providers evaluate the word short is different. And that means shortest path across the entire network is sort of a meaningless concept now. Right? You don't have any common way of evaluating the word short between all these different parties. So in particular, what this reveals is that these different domains are going to have their own goals for how they want packets to go. Business contracts are what they use to connect their networks together. This protocol, which is called the Border Gateway Protocol, is what handles the task of figuring out where packets should go when they move between networks. Right? So what I mean by this is that you can imagine that, since there's a network of networks, suppose that Stanford actually has two providers it's connected to outside. It's connected to, let's say, Level 3 and Sprint. I'm not actually sure. I think Level 3 is right. I'm not sure about Sprint, though. It's connected to Level 3 and Sprint. And at any given point in time, Stanford may have preferences about whether it wants to send packets out through Level 3 or out through Sprint. Okay? In principle, it should be able to reach, and it can, in reality, reach a very similar set of destinations either way. So it doesn't distinguish between them on the basis of what destinations it can reach. It'll distinguish based on, am I going to pay a lot if I use this connection right now? Am I going to pay a lot if I use this connection right now? Is this connection more reliable right now? Okay. So for example, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, on Sand Hill Road, sends terabytes of data to Switzerland, to CERN, on what's called the High Energy Physics Network, which is data collected from physics experiments. Now, you know, it's really important that the data gets there in a reasonably timely fashion. And we're talking about terabytes of data. That's a lot. And you know, oftentimes the joke that's used is the highest bandwidth connection would be FedEx. So when they're trying to set up a telecommunications network to replicate what putting a bunch of, you know, CDs into a FedEx truck or a FedEx plane and sending them to Switzerland would do, well, with a high bandwidth network there, they'd really like to be using that high bandwidth network when they have to transmit these things. But if such a network is going to be expensive, you wouldn't want, you know, your researchers at Slack to be watching streaming CNN video over the same network, right? So I mean, there's, you know, there's trade-offs that are made, and you decide these things often not based on distance, not based on where you have capacity, but based on how much you're paying for capacity, right? That's only one example. We're going to see more. The reality is that then what ends up happening is that routing between providers becomes based on contracts and prices and dollars instead of based on just pure distance. And actually, it need not always be based on dollars. I mean, there's this point remains that I made that you will evaluate how expensive or cheap things are in different ways. Different providers will do so in different ways. You know, so I think a really nice picture of this is that you're sitting here in Palo Alto, and CNN, let's pretend the CNN server is in Atlanta, Georgia. I keep saying Atlanta because CNN is, you know, an Atlanta-based company. So the shortest path you could draw on a map, you just draw a straight line from Palo Alto to Georgia. When you look at the map and watch where your packets really go, you'll see a zigzag. A zigzag can actually be pretty crazy. I mean, it could go as far north as Chicago, and it could go, you know, as far south as LA, for example, from here. So there's not, even if there is a straight line path available, you can see some pretty interesting zigs and zags through that map, right? And why does that happen? Well, it happens because ASs actually have a lot of control over where packets go, and they exercise that control consistent with the contracts that they have, right? So let's look at the kinds of contracts that providers can form. And there's really two main kinds, and one is the kind that you're all familiar with. It's what's called a transit contract. For a moment, think of yourself as an autonomous system. You're not really in the technical sense, because you don't have a number associated to you in this registry or anything, but you are an autonomous system in the sense that you're one person who has your own interests at heart, and you pay for internet access. Well, how do you pay? Most of us, what we'll do is, you know, one of us will pay another provider, and what we're asking that provider to give us is connectivity to the entire internet, both up and down. I want to make sure that anything I send gets to wherever it's going, and I want to make sure that anything that's supposed to get to me gets to me. Now, one of those two things is a lot easier to verify than the other, right? It's a lot easier to verify that what you sent out actually got where it was supposed to go, especially if it's mission critical. You can always verify that you know, when you sent a credit card transaction out or something, that it actually was processed because you can pick up the phone. It's a lot harder to verify that when someone wanted to get to you, they could. This is a really big problem with the internet. How does a customer realize there's a problem where others can't reach him? Okay, that's actually a very interesting issue. It's a very big problem. I'm not going to say much more about that right now, but that's a problem to keep in the back of your mind. So that's what's called a transit contract. A pays B for all connectivity to and from the entire internet. Okay? So, of course, in order to make that happen, B can't stand alone. It has to have other contracts. There's parts of the internet that other providers are connected to. There's no way B could reach those parts of the internet if it didn't have connectivity to the rest of the internet, right? So it's going to have to form additional contracts to support this. But this isn't very different from contracts that you and I see all the time. So you take your, you know, let's say that you live in an apartment building, and the apartment building says that, you know, we promise that facility, like utilities and things like that, will be functional. Okay, so the central air conditioner goes out. Well, how does the apartment building deliver on what they promised they would give you? They have a contractor who comes in and fixes the air conditioning. Okay, so there's always, in all aspects of life, there's a hierarchical sequence of contracts that deliver on promises that are made. And this is no different. B makes a promise to A, and to deliver on that contract, it forms contracts with others behind it. Okay. So, you know, we talked about this, that transit contracts are what you have with your ISP. I have this sentence here mainly for terminology. Oftentimes, when one provider enters into another contract with another by buying a transit contract, we just say that by saying they bought transit. That's sort of the usual terminology in the industry. And I say smaller and larger in quotes because this can be very misleading. Smaller and larger, it's very hard to evaluate. Do I mean dollar terms? Do I mean the size of the network? You can actually have very dominant industry players in a size or dollar, you know, in market cap sense, that are buying transit from potentially much smaller players. So this is difficult to ascribe a size to. Typically, though, it will be the case that both a larger player in the sense of a larger network and a player with a higher market cap would be someone who's more likely to get a, you know, to sell a transit contract in this space. But you should be aware, I keep warning you not to assign like very hard, rigid categories to these things because there isn't a hard and fast rule for how to do it. All right, and the other example of a contract is what's called a peering contract. So in a peering contract, two providers agree to costlessly exchange traffic that's destined for each other. So what does costlessly mean, first of all, and what does destined for each other mean? First of all, costlessly is easy to define. They form this link, and they just don't, no money changes hand. Okay, it's often called bill and keep is the name for it. Bill, in the sense that you may tell each other, we're going to form this link, but keep in the sense that you don't actually make any payments. Right? So what does destined for each other mean? That's a bit more subtle. It doesn't just mean destinations that are inside the network itself. It actually means, typically, destinations that are reachable through this network and any customers of his that have bought transit, and any customers of his customers. Okay, so what you can imagine is that there's a tree hanging off of this guy of networks. So you can have more networks down here that all bought transit from him, more networks under him, and so on, that bought transit from that second layer. And the same thing over here. So when I say for each other, I actually mean that entire tree. I don't mean just this guy at the top. So a good example of something like this would be AT&T and Sprint. Okay, so AT&T is a large national backbone, international backbone. Same thing with Sprint. But they have a different customer base. You know, AT&T now, for example, after the merger with SBC, has a large number of residential DSL customers that Sprint doesn't have. And conversely, you know, Sprint has some content providers that AT&T doesn't have. So peering between those two means that if there's a content provider connected to Sprint who wants to send to a DSL customer of AT&T, then they can do so across that link. And they do so for free in the sense that there's no money changing hands between AT&T and Sprint to form this link. Okay. Now, it might not be surprising that transit and peering are obviously two very different things. All things being equal, AT&T would much prefer to get a payment from Sprint for that link. Okay, but similarly, Sprint would prefer to get a payment from AT&T for that link. The reason that there's often not a payment is that they're similar in size, and there's enough flow both ways that they both sort of agree that whatever that payment would have been, it's probably about the same. So let's just agree not to bother measuring it, put in the peering link. We're going to see this causes a lot of problems, though, so we'll come back to that. But this is kind of the point I wanted to make. The peering contracts are typically established between ISPs of similar size with similar traffic going to each other's network. Okay. And so I'm going to put this slide up, and then I want to pause for a second, ask some questions, and see if there's any questions, and make sure you understand what the difference is between these two. So by many accounts, the internet looks like a hierarchy. And typically, people talk about three tiers. So tier three is a collection of nodes that get all their connectivity to the entire internet by only buying transit. Right? This might be you, your own home computer, maybe Stanford, maybe another enterprise network like IBM, let's say. So these are customers, basically. They buy internet access, and that's the only way they get internet access. They don't have any other type of contract. So there's money going this way, and services delivered in both directions. Now, when you move up one tier, you see kind of a mix. You see guys that buy transit, but maybe also have a peering contract or two. A really good example of this is someone like Google. I mean, Google is huge. Google does buy transit. They buy transit because they don't have their own network to deliver everything that they want to deliver. But oftentimes, especially in large cities, Google has found it productive to rather than, you know, so suppose you're in a large city, right, in, you know, Chicago, let's say. Google has a data center in Chicago. We talked about internet exchanges briefly last time, and if Google is connected to the internet exchange in Chicago, then if there's a regional provider regional network provider of Chicago, let's say that, you know, in Chicago, I think it's also SBC, so now AT&T, that delivers DSL service in Chicago. So both Google and AT&T are connected into this internet exchange. Why would Google bother paying for transit service there? Why not just peer directly with AT&T and say, let's forget about, you know, my traffic going through the internet exchange to a transit provider and then back to you. Why don't I just peer directly with you? Just send the traffic over directly. Okay? And again, you can ask questions, why would both sides do this? Well, AT&T does it because Google has a lot of valuable content. Google does it because it's cheaper. It doesn't have to pay for transit anymore. Right? So this peering link here, actually another really great example, I know we have a bunch of people who have international experience, in Asia, you know, particularly examples like Korea and Indonesia, I talked about how in the early days of the internet, providers, Asian providers, had to ship packets all the way back to the US just to get it across the street. So you could have two different providers in Korea, and if all they were doing was using transit, then in the early days, they would have bought transit from a US provider. That means the packets that are moving from one Korean provider to another go all the way back to the US and then all the way back to Korea. This is an obvious case where peering locally is good. Okay? But peering isn't good enough for those Korean providers, because by peering, they can only reach each other. But if they want to reach the entire internet, they still need transit service to get to other destinations outside of Korea. So that's a very good example of a hybrid mix between peering and transit. Not surprisingly, the more of this happens, the less money moves up this way, and the worse it is for guys up here. So the nightmare for the guys at the top is that everybody under them starts to peer for all the major traffic, and that this becomes very lightly loaded. Yeah?
Is that increasing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really on the rise. It's on the rise for a variety of reasons. It's on the rise because as sort of the technology, network technology has proliferated, there's obviously not as high a barrier to entry to accomplishing these kinds of things. So, you know, in the early days, the US could be sort of, without being too extreme about it, the US could be arrogant about saying, well, hey, you know, we've got the new technology, so come connect here. But that's not really the case anymore. I mean, it's much more of a level playing field. So countries in Asia can easily set up internet exchanges that enable this sort of peering. So there's a very, very influential company in that space called Packet Clearinghouse that's based in Berkeley. It's a nonprofit, and that's what they do. They help set up internet exchanges in countries like Indonesia and so on, that basically enable this level of peering to cut out the middleman and this up-payment of transit. So it is on the rise. It's also on the rise because, you know, taking out this sort of international politics approach, of course, providers like Google and so on that are very geographically diverse, they have servers all over the place, obviously find it in their best interest to enable this over transit because it's much, much cheaper. Well, actually, they are already. All the major content providers that you're thinking that you just listed there, and you know, similar scale, they are either they're all tier two, or they are paying for a content delivery network. We talked about Akamai briefly last time, which then is effectively a tier two provider. So, Akamai again has similar sort of sets of wide variety of relationships, and so, you know, so there's. I think that it's definitely true that a large content provider has a huge incentive to try to avoid these heavy transit costs moving up. And the top providers then get squeezed. See, one of the themes that's recurrent here is that data service is a commodity. You know, it's no different from corn or wheat or something like that. There's not enough differentiation in what that pipe is delivering you. And you know, it's hard to tell the difference between spam and a credit card transaction. It's hard to tell the difference between a phone call and a file transfer. And so similarly, look, I mean, when these guys buy transit, they don't really get very strong guarantees about what they're getting from that link. I mean, it's hard for someone up here to guarantee end-to-end what the performance is going to be. So, I mean, there isn't enough differentiation. You know, if you're only delivering a commodity of connecting me over to all these other places, if I can circumvent one link in that commodity, I'll do it. So it's a big problem, actually, for the internet. That's one point I wanted to make. The other point, I guess, to note here is that I mentioned that in almost every walk of life, we see this hierarchical contracting to deliver stuff that we buy. One big, big difference in the internet is that, you know, in that hierarchical contracting that I talked about for like the, you know, the electrician who comes to fix the air conditioning unit in an apartment building, different apartment buildings compete with each other. Okay, so it's not like, you know, two apartment buildings never need to cooperate with each other. They're both competing for the same pool of customers, of tenants. Different electricians compete with each other. And once an electrician has signed up with one apartment building, he may have a contract with another as well, but you know, his goal is just to sort of maximize his own profit. And there's not really much interaction between the layers of that hierarchy besides selling the electrician's service. Here, there's a really big difference. Network providers compete and cooperate all the time. These guys at the top, just to finish that story, these are called Tier 1 and deliver service exclusively through peering and having sold transit. These guys, they cooperate. Why do they cooperate? Well, if this link was severed, then there would be no availability of this tree to this player. That's huge. If he loses connectivity to a part of the internet, his customers get really unhappy. So he has to cooperate to be able to deliver that connectivity. But he's competing with this guy. They're selling the same service, right? So I think a fundamental underlying question for the internet is, can you have a collection of players who have to compete and cooperate to deliver the good that they're promising? It's very rare. I mean, I encourage you to think about it. There are other examples, but it's rare that you encounter a situation where the delivery of this service depends on the competition and cooperation of all the players in the industry. You know, and I mean, it's a public good. We all need it desperately. And yet, it's amazing that we've entrusted it to this very novel economic architecture working itself out. Okay? All right, so let me pause there first of all, ask about peering, transit, internet hierarchy, tier one, tier two, tier three. Any questions about that?
The peering and the transit at the level two, I mean, that must be really embryonic, right, at the moment.
What do you mean embryonic? Early stages. And it depends where you look. So there's some exchanges that have actually been operational for a while and that really have enabled a lot of that regional tier two peering in Asia. It's definitely true that on a grand scale, it is still relatively new. Again, the internet was only deregulated in 95, so the entire industry at some level is only a decade old. And then beyond that, this type of sort of understanding of the technology and the costs involved is really evolving very rapidly. So I would say that, you know, I think the Asian peering probably evolved really in the early part of this decade. Asian tier two development. And, for content providers, again, I mean, if we look even 6 years ago, Google is nothing like what it is today. So the evolution of this kind of contracting is also in parallel with the evolution of the application space and the changes there. Is that sort of along the lines of what you're talking about? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating because, you know, AOL give connectivity away for free, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they were forced to.
Yeah.
On the other side, you get, you know, companies like Google building Substrate.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's newfound, and at an international level, you know, it's just the way that people look at information. Some of it's domestic, and some of it's international.
Yep.
And therefore, as content becomes more regional or domestic, you know, that almost accelerates some of that peering and transit.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think coming back to the first thing that you said about the little guys nipping at the heels of the big guys. It is a good example of why I said you have to be careful about the relation between market cap and large and small in tier one and tier two. Obviously, Google has a much higher market cap than many of these tier one guys. So, and at the same time, you're right. Google is one of these tier two guys in this hierarchy in the sense that they do buy transit. I think to some extent, the ability to build out your own backbone is motivated by being someone who has a higher market cap than the guys you're buying the service from. At the same time, I think it's important to realize that the fact that different players are taking very different approaches to dealing with this uncertainty suggests how difficult hedging your risk in this environment is. You know, I think in part Google's uncertainty is about, will we have a delivery mechanism for the content that we're generating? Okay, will we be discriminated against at this level? Now, Google's worried about discrimination at two levels, access and backbone. For the backbone, it's a clear sell that they want to buy backbone capacity because they have an enormous amount of data to ship anyway. That's a short-term gain that's clearly going to happen. And the access level is a much harder thing to penetrate. You know, short of buying out an access provider, it's hard to see an easy penetration mechanism. And now you start to see why it's useful for Google to be investing in municipal wireless, in selling wireless or giving away wireless for free, basically. That's a major part of the strategy. Because if I can ensure there's just another avenue for people to get in that sort of keeps my content flowing without constraints imposed by players down here, then okay, maybe, you know, maybe actually this net neutrality thing can be avoided in some way. And so there is strategic decision making behind everything that you see. But the variety of different strategies that are pursued, and we haven't really gotten into detail yet about the kinds of things we might see, but the variety of different strategies that are pursued suggest a lot of uncertainty about really what the right contracting architecture for the future is. But I think at a high level, you know, again, both for a layperson and sort of a business person in this space, the really important question we have to keep asking is it self-sustaining as an economic architecture? Is the internet self-sustaining as an economic architecture? You know, particularly given the fact that these players have to compete and cooperate against each other, and that the technology is what it is it self-sustaining? Okay, so again, we're going to get into that now a bit more. Any other questions, though?
Just an interesting observation. I mean, Best Buy bought a retail company. They bought a second-tier telco. I'm not sure.
Oh, I wasn't aware of this.
Yeah, they bought it, and you know.
When did this happen?
Just like last two months or something.
Oh, okay.
Yep. You know, so you get non-IT&T players buying these peering and transit companies, essentially, right? Access providers, right?
Well, okay, let's be a little bit careful. So there's a big distinction between buying Skype and buying a retail ISP. So the ISP is providing network service, and he really is one of the boxes in here.
Right.
Skype is an application.
Right.
And so it is true that if you're buying a retail ISP, then you're sort of buying into this space. And you're buying into it strategically because you think it's helping you circumvent other costs that you see or deliver another service that you wanted to push. If you're buying Skype, it's a little bit different. It's an application level thing that you're buying because given the entire framework that we're talking about here, there's something you can exploit strategically to make money in.
I mean, from an economic point of view, it's almost like there's this vertical integration.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
you're right about
vertical. I've come to the conclusion a little bit looking at this and saying, well, the verticals would probably buy because they can lower the cost of customer acquisition or customer service.
Yeah,
which was kind of the Best Buy buying.
So actually, that's a good thing to come back to. We're going to talk about vertical integration again next lecture. It is one of the economic issues I want to discuss is the impact of vertical integration. So just one note on that. Vertical integration refers to the idea that you have effectively an entire chain of providers, of industries covered all the way from backbone down to access and potentially even applications. Right. So a good example of vertical integration is the SBC-AT&T merger. You're merging backbone services with access services and actually content as well. Okay. All right, but let's. So I'm going to skip the tiering. The tiers revisited. Wow, we're really flying along here. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about a couple examples before we finish up. Okay, so here's one example. Suppose that CNN has actually two transit connections. It's paying $20 per megabit per second, $40 per megabit per second. Now these two guys are peered, and then this is an ISP that has a bunch of eyeballs. Now eyeballs is a common term in this industry for customers, people like you and me. It's good to know we've been reduced to this part of the small part of our anatomy. So these guys are paying ISP2 for internet access, of course. And so what's happening here is that he's got two transit contracts and one peering contract. He has one transit contract. Now, right at this time point, this transit contract is cheaper than this one. And what's going to happen then is that CNN probably will prefer to send traffic this way instead of this way. Now, of course, the eyeballs have paid for monthly internet access. But you would think that ISP2 would like, you know, as content is shuttled in here that's valuable, you would think that ISP2 would look over and say, hey, that's $20 a megabit per second. I should be getting a little piece of that. I mean, it's going over here. Why not give me some? And if not, one thing he could do is just drop his price to 19 and then just snag it for himself.
I'm missing who's paying whom.
Oh, sorry, CNN, any payment. These guys aren't paying anybody anything. All payment is up to here, and then down from CNN. Yep.
CNN pays those?
CNN is paying these two guys,
okay.
Exactly, yeah. Sorry, I should have clarified that. I should probably put an arrow with the dollar sign here, yeah. So the point here is that, first of all, in the internet, there's no transmission of value across this link. There's no dollar flow across this link, which means on a connection by connection basis, there's no movement of money across the entire route. That's very different from a telephone call. In a telephone network, when you pay 10 cents a minute, the provider you're paying that 10 cents takes a little bit and then passes the rest on. And then the next guy takes a little bit, passes the rest on. You can do that in a telephone network because you're setting up a connection and then taking it down with every phone call. You can't do that here because you can't really attach to every packet, you know, what the value of the packet is. The internet doesn't let you do that. We talked about that. So that's the first thing to realize. On a connection-by-connection basis, there's no transmission of dollars across the entire connection. So then what you're really left with is you have to charge in aggregates. You have to charge. That means that you're reduced to not accepting any money either way here and charging in aggregate every customer here for a monthly connection and charging CNN on a long-term basis per megabit per second. That's the first point. The second point is that, of course, ISP2 doesn't have an incentive. It has a big incentive to lower its price to CNN here. Because obviously it looks around and says, if I just lower it to 19, I'm going to grab all the traffic. And that's a big win for me. I'm sending it. I mean, the point is it's sending it anyway. It's already set up this link. Why not get all the money from it? But then he's going to go to 18. And then you just see a race to the bottom. Right? And that's a really important insight, that what will happen is that prices will plummet to near zero. So in an economic sense, what's happening is that if you have two peers that are selling the same service, what they've done is they've made themselves indistinguishable to the consumer. In this case, these two guys, they look the same to CNN. No matter who he connects to, he can reach the eyeballs. He doesn't really care about where this link is. He can use the peering link, or he can just go straight. So these two guys are basically indistinguishable if this link is, you know, big enough and everything. So if they look indistinguishable, there's a race to the bottom on the price. And that's exactly what we observed in this decade. And in 2002, running 2001 to about 2004, there's a precipitous drop in the price of transit in the United States. Fell from about, again, this is all really anecdotal, but people think it fell from on the order of $600 per megabit per second to something closer to 80. Okay, and it's, continued to drop since then. Now people think it is likely down to something like 40 in some cases.
I'm shocked that it's that high because my Comcast, I pay less than that.
What's that?
I can pay you less than that for Comcast
service. Yeah, no, that's true. You do pay less for a Comcast service. On the other hand, there's a couple things to keep in mind here. One is that they're paying for a lot more than just, so the customer service you're getting from Comcast is at nowhere near the level of what they're talking about here. They're paying for a 24-hour network services center and so on. So, a center that their network operations guy can call up. That's the first thing to keep in mind. And the other thing is that they are actually paying for some sort of guaranteed quality on that link as well. I haven't really gotten into detail on that. But so in practice, you know, it's true that it's a little bit more expensive than what your access line looks like. I would argue, actually, that what we're paying is a lot. Because the thing is that for Comcast to deliver what they're promising to us, the line that they've provisioned upstream is actually relatively low capacity, and they're actually getting everybody in a neighborhood to pay for that line. Now, that's a lot more than this at some level. It's not more than this per megabit per second, but it's more in a dollar cost sense of provisioning the link. So, okay. So this is one thing. What will end up happening is revenues fall, and they no longer cover the cost of investment, first of all, but in fact, they don't even cover the cost of operation. So the anecdotal evidence is that every backbone service provider loses money on their IP network services. And then that points to vertical integration. What's the point of losing money on your IP network service? Well, the only reason you would do it is if you think it's going to help you make money somewhere else. And one way you might be making money is because either you have a lot of content or you have a lot of eyeballs. And for these guys, you're able to use the long-haul network to send data around. Right? So we're going to talk about that kind of economic level a bit more next time. But what I want you to see here right now is that the nature of the peering contract makes players indistinguishable to large customers. And it creates a race to the bottom on price. And this is very, very crisply what we observed in this industry in the first few years of this decade. Okay. Let's see. I want to try to get through one more example, I guess. Let me just finish this one, and then we'll start up next time. So one possible solution to this, well, the obvious thing, Okay, why not just attach a value to every connection? I mean, 10 cents a minute on a phone call, let's just do that. Just say this is like, you know, 3 cents a connection or something like that. And then you just share it the same way we share it now. You know, the 10 cents a minute is shared between the sequence of providers that it takes to get to the destination. Why not do the same thing here? Well, the problem with that kind of sharing is that the internet doesn't enable it. If you're going to do that kind of sharing, you need to have a way in advance when you set up the contract of doing the calculation of saying, okay, well, let's see, if this connection is 3 cents a minute, that one's 10 cents a minute, I expect about 5 million of these, 2 million of those, do all the math and figure out where money should go. The beauty of these negotiations is it's so hard that you can't even agree on the direction money should flow, let alone the number. Okay? And there's a lot of examples of this. I mean, I talked about US versus the world last time a little bit about negotiations. I won't go into this anymore. Early peering negotiations are a really nice example, though. So right after 1995, when the NSFNet was decommissioned, one of the things that had to happen was providers had to sit down and think, okay, well, you know, we're going to set up this link, and we have a contract for that link. How much should we pay each other? So you get this boardroom meeting, and the guys go away, and they say, okay, I'm going to give this to my accountants and network engineers, and they start going through the numbers and thinking about, well, what's the net, you know, revenue generation, what's the net cost of maintaining the link, and cost of transiting traffic for your sending through traffic that comes from your peer. And they both get back together, and each of them puts a number on a piece of paper and slides it across, and they both have numbers that are positive, which means they both think the other should be paying them. So they can't even agree on who should pay whom. Okay? It's not like, you know, think about all the negotiations you go through. When you go buy a car, there's no dispute about who should be paying who for the car. You don't open the negotiation by saying, I think you should pay me $1,000 to take this off your hands. But that's actually what happens here. I mean, what happens is that, what happened was that, I mean, even just looking at the network and the traffic flow and what the customer base was, it was impossible to identify what direction money should move in. I can't stress what kind of a market failure that is. I find it very hard to think of other examples where this happens. Okay? On a grand scale, anyway. The Comcast compared to Akamai example, that's just interesting because Comcast mostly has traffic flowing into its network. Akamai mostly has traffic that it sends out because it generates content, okay, or serves content. Now, again, here the traffic flow is unidirectional. Right? So if they sat down at a table and said, let's form a link, who should pay whom? Well, if money went with traffic, it would look like Akamai should obviously be paying Comcast. It's not that obvious. I mean, Akamai has a lot of valuable content. They're probably going to say to Comcast, despite the fact that we generate all the traffic, you should pay us, because I've got CNN and Yahoo on my side. If you want that, you better pay me. Right? So again, one interesting thing about this example is that quantity is not identical to value. Quantity flow is not equivalent. You know, the fact that bits move in this direction does not mean money should move in that direction. Okay? So, you know, these two are very interesting examples. It's interesting to know the direction that money should flow in is not easy to identify. The fact that bits move in a certain direction doesn't mean that money should move in that direction. Okay?
You might even argue you should move the other direction. I want to watch this movie.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
why should you pay me for sending me the book?
There's so many problems with the way that we think about where money should go. And I mean, again, I'm trying to shock you a bit to realize that the way that money moves in the internet is just there's no rhyme or reason to it in terms of the value generated by particular streams. And so, you know, that's the ultimate point here is that value has been equated with quantity. And you might ask why. It's really because that's the only thing the network lets you equate it with. It's sort of the only thing you can really measure. As I already keep telling you, you know, this is very hard in the network to identify different types of traffic and treat them differently. All you're left with is you can measure the bits per second moving through your network, the total bytes that have moved through your network. So quantity is about the only thing you can charge on. And that's the classic definition of a commodity. Okay, it means you don't distinguish between whether this is like, you know, gourmet red popping corn or whether it's corn grown in the Midwest. They're all just corn, and they all get the same price on the open market. And so, again, you know, when quantity is the thing you're selling, you basically become a commodity. And that's why there's this race to the bottom on price to CNN. So, you know, this example we talked about, spam and credit card transactions generate the same quantity of bits, roughly speaking, but they obviously have different values. So. I'll just end this by mentioning this. You know, this is the first of the contracts we'll look at. This is Verizon's peering policy. Now, Verizon, I want to emphasize, merged with MCI. So Verizon is actually now a huge network. I mean, it's not only an access network, but also has a huge backbone. And so what a peering policy says is, these are rules that have to be satisfied if I'm going to accept you as a peer. Because remember, if you're a peer, we build this link and we don't pay each other anything. Anything outside of this Verizon would rather sell you internet service. They don't want it to be up here. So let's look at what they say. I mean, and if you look at this policy, it's much more extensive than this. And there's some really interesting stuff in there that's worth looking at. But here's a couple things. So first of all, there's a geographic scope restriction if you're going to be up here. You have to be geographically dispersed. You have to have a backbone in each of these 8 geographic regions. Actually, it gets more interesting than this. And some peering policies, you'll see what are called the NFL cities. So you have to have a presence in every major city in the US, which are sometimes called the NFL, National Football League cities. These are cities that have NFL teams. I think that's sort of a strange way, because obviously we can think of cities where there's NFL teams where it's not clear that you want to have a presence a priori. I mean, that may not be a huge amount of traffic. There may not be a huge amount of traffic generated there. But these types of restrictions are very common. And the second thing is this traffic ratio. I really want to emphasize that. This is exactly what I just said. Quantity equals value. If we have the same quantity, must be the same value. If we have different quantities, must be different value. Okay? So what does that mean here? It says that the ratio of traffic moving in one direction compared to the other should be 1.8 to 1, no more, no less. So it shouldn't exceed 1.8 to 1 in either direction. Okay? Now again, back to the Comcast Akamai example, could you ever envision them entering a contract where they said, you know what, we need balanced traffic flow in both directions? All right, that's a very strange thing to expect. And actually, it was very, very interesting, and I wish that SBC and AT&T kept this. I mean, it's too bad that they didn't. Right after they merged, it was clear that somebody in the network engineering department just didn't have enough time to update the peering rules. And so what they did was they took the two HTML files, you know, the peering rules for SBC and the peering rules for AT&T, just appended the two together, changed SBC to AT&T everywhere, and put it online. And what's really interesting about this is that SBC is a company that has mostly DSL customers. So they would never have a restriction like this. So you read about SBC, and it says if you want to peer with AS number, you know, whatever it was, which is the SBC, the old SBC AS number, then there was no traffic ratio restriction. There couldn't be. It wouldn't make any sense. But then you read down a little bit further, and then it says, on the other hand, if you want to peer with AS number X, which is the AT&T AS number, you have to have a traffic ratio of 2 to 1, right? Which is really strange. So it's simultaneously on the same page. They had two different networks. They just merged them together and said, if you want to peer with this one, I don't have any traffic ratio restriction, for obvious reasons, because I'm going to be the one who's syncing traffic from you. And for AT&T, it said, you know, for the old AT&T network, it said, there's a traffic ratio restriction. So I mean, I found that fascinating, because it was clear that, like, in the process of the merger, they hadn't thought through, well, what do we do with this traffic ratio thing? Because again, they don't know. What's the net impact? What's the value flow? Is value quantity anymore, or is it not quantity, right? So this is really an important lesson to take away. Value equals quantity is the rule of the current internet. I just don't think it's the right rule. And it's at the root of the network neutrality discussion, because ultimately, network neutrality is the point. It's trying to preserve the idea that value can be associated with a very simple sort of commodity concept, which is quantity or something like that. But once there's all these different characteristics that we care about, delay, loss, is it a telephone call? Is it a file transfer? Then it's not so easy to say that value is quantity. Value is sort of associated with something more than quantity, with type or with quality. And when that happens, then it really complicates the process of pricing the service the internet delivers. So it's something we're going to return to when we talk about economics. So I'll finish these examples next time. I'm sorry about splitting lectures across multiple sessions, but on the other hand, I think you've raised a lot of interesting questions, so that's part of the reason I keep it going that way. And so I'll continue this next time, and then we'll get into the sort of economic level discussion a bit as well. And I know I ran over, but if anyone does have any comments they want to add or questions, I'm happy to stick around and discuss anything that you have in mind.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.